Jesus didn't have a problem with people that's in the streets. He had a problem with religious people.
How can I help anybody when I'm not even, when I was not even able to help my own son?
I would never do that. I would never do that. And I became that in a matter of minutes when they took my pain pills away.
And I said, I'm not where I want to be, but thank God I'm not what I used to be.
Ugh. This is Faith in Your Recovery. I am Randy Davis. Welcome to the battle. As always, and once again, it's great to have you with us here today for Faith in Your Recovery. We're glad you've joined us. If you haven't subscribed, make sure you get subscribed to our program. We want to keep you up on everything that's going on. That'll help show some support for us. Like, of course, by this being a live program, you're welcome to text in your questions or comments. And I've already spoken with our guest. He's up for that. All right. And we want to be able to drain him in a very positive way of his experience, his knowledge, his wisdom, and all that he's been a part of. That guest today, from Wisconsin, Captain Adam Myers. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you, Randy. Thanks for having me. And this is a great opportunity for us to talk about things. So I really appreciate this.
Well, we appreciate your time and your willingness. We wouldn't be here without folks like you. Sorry for the experience you've had to deal with, but we're anxious to hear about it, to see what we can learn and glean from that, and maybe make better choices the next time, each and every one of us. So let's just go ahead and tell the folks a little about yourself, who you are today. When you look in the mirror, who do you see?
Well, I actually see a guy who probably puts too much hair gel in my hair, but, you know, that's okay. I'm 50 years old. I'm still a police officer. I'm a captain in Wisconsin, but more importantly, I'm a father of two daughters. Sydney Marie is 27 and Peyton Elizabeth is 23. I am divorced, but my ex-wife and I get along very well.
Great.
And that's important. I've always wanted to be a police officer as far back as I can remember. When I was a little boy, I lived on Highway 20 or Washington Avenue in the city of Racine, which is in Wisconsin. And I'd hear sirens and run up to the window and look outside and look at my parents and say, hey, an ur car, because of that siren. So they said the first time I saw a police officer get out of an ur car, I was just so in awe. And I looked at them and I said, an ur car man, I want to be an ur car man. So I grew up and did what I thought I needed to do to become an ur car man, you know, graduate from high school, go to college, join the military. And I went through a critical incident in 2016, poorly coped, but I'm doing well now. I'm doing healthy now because I put myself first. And that's difficult for a lot of people, you know, especially first responders, because we tend to put everybody else first and not take care of ourselves.
Constant call.
Yeah. Eventually the poor coping caught up to me and I couldn't do it anymore. And I had to put myself first. So, and I'm glad I did, because one of the reasons why you and I are speaking together, because otherwise I have no doubt I wouldn't be here.
We want to hear that story about that incident here in a little bit. I'm interested. You said something there that kind of strikes a tone with me. I'm also a veteran in the U.S. Army. Tell us a little about your military experience, please.
Sure. I was active duty 5 years military police in the Army. I went to training at Fort McClellan, Alabama, which is Anniston, Alabama. And then after that, I was stationed at Fort Bliss, Texas, which is El Paso, Texas. I didn't go overseas. I didn't see any conflicts, but I did military police support on the base, and I thought that was great. That just kind of confirmed that I wanted to be a police officer. All my life, I wanted to, and then I figured, yeah, I'll join the Army and be a cop in the Army, and I loved it. It gave me the training, the experience, the discipline, the confidence to keep going, not only as a police officer, but just in life. It instilled in me, you know, more work ethics and good work ethics and morals. And it was a great experience.
My military experience was one of the best things that's ever happened to me. As far as maturity in life in general, it made a world of difference. And I still draw still draw on much of that. So that's where you had your first connection as an Ur-man, yeah?
Yeah, an Urkar man, you betcha.
Urkar, I mean, yeah.
Yeah, the camaraderie that I experienced in the military, I have never experienced that anywhere else. I mean, you still have it in the law enforcement profession, but just something different about being in the Army, just something different about that camaraderie in the military. And that's important. I would encourage everybody to join the armed forces, you know, one branch or the other. It was a great experience, and I've carried that with me throughout my life.
You know, I was just telling my wife the other day that if I had the opportunity to reconnect with somebody from my future, my military friends would be right at the top. That was back in the Vietnam War that I served. I was in Germany, never under any danger of any type. But still, that connection, as you said, that camaraderie, that carrying on each other and knowing you could carry on each other made a world of difference.
And just like any other job, you know, there may be people that you don't like that much or whatever, but you were still there for each other.
Of course.
You still backed each other up. It didn't matter what your personal opinions were. You were there. You were a team. And that camaraderie is great.
I come from rural East Central Indiana, and to get in there with folks from Boston and LA and Texas, you know, connections I had never made and don't know when I would have. I'd have been much older and would not been as receptive, I'm sure. So it was a good thing. And I recognize for some it's not. Those who end up on that field of battle, that's not a smiling, celebratory kind of moment. I'm thankful for them, but I'm thankful for those who have served at home and abroad. That's a long-term history in my family. So you come back home from the military. What's life look like at that point for you, Adam?
Well, you know, I was married at the time, and I had my oldest daughter, Sydney, and I just got to work right away looking for a job. I wanted to be a police officer. I moved back to my hometown in Racine, where it all started, where I wanted to be a police officer, where I was born and raised. And I actually applied for the Racine Police Department, and I went through the process, and about a year of going through the process, I was hired. I was hired by my hometown. It was great because I still remember after I was done with training and being in my squad car driving in downtown Racine, the county buildings have these big mirrored windows. And I remember looking over and seeing myself, you know, driving the squad car. And I'm thinking, wow, I'm really doing it. This is great. And so I had a great opportunity to police the community that I love, that I was raised in, and then I had a family. And it was great.
So take us to the next level. Let's go back. How big of a town, city, whatever the case may be, is Racine? An approximate population. Give us a ballpark.
Sure. Racine at the time was 85,000 population. It was located. It's located between Chicago, Illinois, and Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and bordered by Lake Michigan. So we got our fair share of activity from, you know, the bigger cities and our city ourselves. And then after about 5.5 years, I moved up north and joined another police department. My ex-wife and I moved up north, kind of trying to get back to the basics of a family. Racine was pretty intense with policing just because I was a third shift evidence technician. So I went to a lot of the homicides, a lot of the gang crimes, a lot of the drive-bys, stuff like that. And there just came to a point where I became calloused to some of that. I remember one specific time, I remember walking into a bar with all my evidence gear, and I look over to the right, and there was a deceased man in the doorway. And I'm thinking, okay, just another body. Let's get to work. And it's not just another body. And it doesn't matter if they were a gang member or if they were a CEO of a business or homeless, it's still a person. It's still somebody's son. So I started getting callous. So I started looking elsewhere for a job, you know, kind of smaller community, and in hopes to reconnect as a family and then just, you know, reconnect as being a police officer.
That You know, I've spoken with many officers over the years. I've never been in law enforcement directly or even indirectly other than a chaplain for the county sheriff's department. But I've heard those similar words from many of them. And I have seen that through our work with those who suffer in it. Through addiction and struggle with all of that, how they're right. oftentimes just thought it's just another addict. It's just right. another junkie. Right. And to a point, don't misunderstand me, anybody, but I almost get it because it's the same guy they helped yesterday or the day before, and there he is again. They brought him back. They got him to the hospital. They Narcanned him, whatever the case may have been. But it's still, as you said, it's somebody's loved one. Even if that right. loved one has passed, there's somebody who cares about us all. And so, all right. So you moved to that smaller community for a different pace and, you know, different circumstances. Did that play out as you hoped it would?
It didn't. But, you know, first, Randy, thanks for your chaplaincy. I appreciate that. Sheriff's departments, police departments, they all need that. So bravo to you, because I'm sure you've heard and seen things that you probably wouldn't have. So thank you. What you did was important. And, you know, I did. I moved up. I moved up north, and it didn't play out. And I moved up north, and on April 8th, 2016, I was involved in a critical incident. I used deadly force on someone who armed themselves with a hatchet inside our Walmart store. And never thought that would happen in a smaller community. I would more expect something like that to happen at a larger community, but it happened to me.
What size was the community that you were in? The population ballpark?
Yeah, the population of that community was about 7,000. It was located between two larger communities, one to the north that had about 65 to 70,000, and then one to the south that had about, 15 to 20,000. So also we had major state highways that ran through our community. So we had our fair share of activity, just like Racine. Racine was a bigger city. We were smaller up north, but everybody kind of merged on our community because we had Walmart, we had other retail stores, we had stores that people would frequent for, like working on their homes and stuff like that. So we had people coming in and out of our community all the time, even though it was a small population.
Going back to your time in Racine, had you ever experienced a moment like you're about to share with us concerning this incident?
I hadn't. I mean, there were times that I drew my weapon. There were times that I was in foot pursuits and vehicle pursuits. And, I remember drawing a weapon on somebody who had a knife, but at the last minute, they dropped the knife, so I didn't have to shoot. Nothing like this. And I always prided myself in never having to use force. I mean, I've been a police officer for 23 years now, and I still have never pepper sprayed anybody. I have never used my baton on anybody. I have always just been good at talking people down and convincing them not to get physical, because I don't want to fight anybody. And the majority of the police officers don't want to get physical with anybody. We're there to help. We're not there to fight. We're certainly not there to shoot and kill somebody. So I had never experienced anything like this before in my career.
Go ahead and tell us as much as you feel comfortable telling us about that story. I listened to the 911 call with the transcript that you sent us, and I was almost shaking in my shoes listening to it. I don't mind telling you that. And came okay. to
yeah,
know
I was,
tears it as shook, it, it fell apart. It's
right. It shook me up a lot too. So that day I started my shift. I was working uniform patrol. I started my shift at 11 a.m. and it was a typical shift. Nothing really uncommon. And I was inside the police department working on a retail theft report when I was dispatched to our Walmart. And the dispatcher advised me, "Can you please respond to Walmart? There's a woman in the store refusing to leave. She's with chaperones." And it wasn't a very emergent call by any means. And later on, I found out that this person, her name was Melissa. She struggled with mental health issues, and and she was a patient at a state mental health facility. She had earned a good behavior pass, and she was out on pass. They had gone to a fast food restaurant, and then they went across the street into our Walmart. Now, when it was time for her to leave, she refused to leave. She wouldn't cooperate with the chaperones, and that's when they called 911. Initially, it was a 911 hang-up call, but our dispatchers called them back and then was able to reconnect with them and kept them on the line the whole time. So I grabbed my laptop and I walked out the back of the police department and jumped in my squad car and started driving to Walmart. And like I said, it wasn't very emergent, but then dispatch advised me that she was trying to rip open, well, she was ripping open a knife from the packaging in sporting goods. And that's when I turned my lights and sirens on and I stepped it up at a higher rate of speed. And then, you know, things changed right there. And I remember when I'm responding, and if your listeners aren't aware, a lot of Walmarts are set up the same. And so what I was thinking was I was going to enter through the auto center because the sporting goods section is back there, in hopes that I would enter through the auto center and kind of contain her back there so she wouldn't walk towards the front of the store and keep her away from some of the customers. Because it was on a Friday, it was 5:15 p.m., very busy, right before the weekend, hundreds of people in the store. But while I was responding, dispatch advised me that she's walking up towards the front of the store. She is threatening customers, damaging merchandise. So my idea, my plan to respond through the auto center changed. So what I did was I entered the parking lot. And I remember when I entered, there were a lot of people in the parking lot. And they're looking at me, but nobody would get out of the way. I'm thinking, will you please move? There's an emergency in the store. But everybody's kind of like, oh, wow, look at the police car. Kind of like when I was a little kid. And finally, what I decided to do was Walmart usually has two entrances. One is the grocery aisle and one is the general merchandise aisle. So I knew she was probably walking up a certain way from the sporting goods section. So I decided to pull my squad car right in front of the general merchandise entrance. I turned my sirens off, but I left my red and blue emergency lights on. And I did that in hopes that if anybody was coming to Walmart and were thinking about going through that entrance, they would change their mind because they would see that police car there and think, yeah, maybe I shouldn't go through there. So I exited my squad car. I drew my weapon right away because I didn't know where she was. And I remember walking towards a man and a woman, and I asked them, where is she? And they kind of pointed down the main aisle towards the lawn and garden and health and beauty aisle. So I ran down towards that area, and I could see her. Her back was facing me, and she was making like a chopping motion. She was chopping up bags of weed and feed that were on top of a pallet. So I gave her, identified myself, I gave her some commands, and then she turned around and faced me. And that's when I realized she didn't have a knife, she had a hatchet. I gave her multiple verbal commands to stop, to drop the hatchet. She continued to advance towards me. And then I just made the decision I have to shoot. And I shot twice. One of my rounds went in and out of one of her legs. And the second round struck her here in the sternum. And then she fell to the ground. There's a lot I don't remember. And, you know, I see a therapist now. They say, you know, your brain protects you from certain things. I'm not a doctor. I'm a cop. I don't get all that. I kind of understand a little bit. But the last thing I remember she was doing was she was walking towards me. And she was making this figure eight kind of swooshing motion with the hatchet. And that's when I decided to shoot. However, there were about a dozen witnesses there. And they said the last thing she did was she raised the hatchet above her head. And that's when I shot. The shots were so loud. Shooting a gun inside a building, it was so loud. It reminded me of like broken speakers. And there were so many people around there. I remember after I had shot, the only way I can explain it was all the clarity kind of came back to me. And it kind of sounded like this. It kind of sounded like, shh, and then everything was crystal clear. But I remember realizing that I had shot her. And then I remember looking around at the people who were there and witnessed it. And I said, please check yourself. Please check each other. I wanted to make sure that my rounds only struck Melissa and nobody else. Then there was a Walmart associate. I don't know if they were a manager, but I said, please get on the intercom and please ask if there's a doctor or a nurse so they can come over here and help until the ambulance gets here. I advised dispatch that shots were fired and that I needed an ambulance. And everything just seemed surreal. One of the first things I remember seeing was this end cap of brightly colored beach towels. And then just kind of bits and pieces of what was going on around me. I knew what I had just done. I knew I did the right thing. And to this day, I know I did the right thing. You can't convince me otherwise. But I was like, I guess I was just in shock. There was a part of me that was in shock. I do remember hearing one of her chaperones that was probably 25, 40 feet away from me. She was still on the 911 call. And she said something similar to, it's the cop. He just shot her. It's the cop. And she was a good distance away from me, but it sounded like she was standing right next to me and saying that in my ear. And I didn't realize that until a few days later when I listened to the 911 call and I'm like, oh my gosh, that was the chaperone. And she was way over there, but it was like she was standing next to me. So once I was cleared to leave from Walmart, my corporal kind of, you know, escorted me out of Walmart. And it was important that he was there because when I joined that police department, he was my field training officer. And it was nice to have him there because I trusted him. I felt comfortable. He was there. I needed somebody there for me because I was still just in and out of realizing what I had just done.
You
so I needed somebody.
Had to be done. Dealing with more shock than most of us will ever face.
Yeah, you're right, Randy. And the thing is I didn't realize it until I was clear. We went back to the police department. Once we got into my corporal's squad car, he's like, hey, check that out. And it was the media. The news was there right away. And once we drove back to the police department, and I remember sitting in the conference room and we went through a few things. But then once I was cleared to leave the police department, I was still in uniform. I didn't have my gun. And I was able to drive home. I had a marked squad car at the time. And maybe that wasn't such a good idea, but I guess at the time we all thought it was. So I just jumped in my squad car and I reached up to my visor and I grabbed my cell phone. And the first thing I did was call my mom and dad because I wanted to let them know what happened to me. And I didn't want them to find out through social media, through the news. And they live 3.5-4 hours away. And I called my mom and dad and let them know, I'm okay, but I want to let you know I shot somebody at work. And later on, my mom and I talked, you know, month later, weeks later, whenever. And she's like, I didn't recognize your voice. I could tell you were in shock. You told me you were okay, but you're my baby boy. I know that you weren't. But even telling her I thought I was okay, I thought I was. So I drove home, and I don't remember the drive home. I lived in that community. I don't remember the drive home, but I probably could tell you what route I took because I usually take the same route every time I go home from work. And I pulled my squad car into the driveway. And then I walked into my house. I was divorced and my daughters were with my ex-wife. So I was home alone, but I walked in my house. And the first thing I did was I kneeled down next to my love seat and I prayed to God that Melissa wouldn't die. I didn't want her to die. I never thought I was going to go to work and have that happen to me. And quite honestly, Randy, I didn't think she was going to die because I guess I didn't realize where I shot her on the upper part of her body, but I knew I shot her in the leg and she was a larger woman. So I was thinking it'll be okay. She's not going to die. And after praying, I took off all my gear and I remember sitting at the foot of my bed and I felt so heavy. Even with all my gear off, I felt so heavy. And then I ordered a pizza and I turned on the news because I wanted to see what was being said about me and what was going on. And I remember the sheriff talking and you know, then I just went to bed and I slept like a rock. I slept really well. I don't know if it's because of the adrenaline dump, but I did. I slept great. And the next morning I woke up. And it was a Saturday. And I thought to myself, all right, Adam, what are you going to do? We got to do something normal, if that's even possible after you shot somebody. Some kind of normalcy this weekend because you have the weekend off. And then on Monday, you're going to go speak with investigators. So what are you going to do? So I decided to go get my hair cut because I usually do that on my day off. And then I was going to pick up my two daughters. And while I'm walking out to to my SUV, my phone rings, and I looked on my phone, and it's the chief calling me. So I sit down in my SUV, and I answer, you know, and it's the typical conversation. Hey, how you doing? I'm doing good. And he asks, when can you come see me? And I told him, I said, I'm going to go get my haircut first and pick up my kids, and then I'll come see you. And I think he asked, when would that be? And I said, maybe around 10 o'clock. And my chief told me, well, I didn't want to tell you this over the phone, but she died. And we talked later, and I respect his decision and admire his decision for telling me that, because he wanted to tell me right away. He didn't want me to find out through social media or the news.
Just as you didn't want your folks to find out.
Right, that too. And I remember ending that conversation, and I'm getting chills now, but I remember just sitting there and thinking, this changes everything. I killed somebody. Now what's going to happen? And
that thought, can you identify that thought? You said, now what's going to happen?
Yeah.
Does that mean professionally, personally, or you don't even know for sure?
Everything. I mean, okay. What's all involved now? I mean, I took somebody's life. I know this is a big deal. I know this doesn't happen a lot. It had never happened in the history of the police department that I worked for. What's going to happen to me? Am I going to get sued? I mean, just everything.
There's no basic protocol to understand what the next step is.
Right. And I knew, I was like, all right, here we go. I'm going to go through all kinds of stuff. And I didn't even know what all kinds of stuff was. But I went and got my hair cut, and I briefly remember that I didn't go get my kids. I think my ex-wife and I may have spoken and said, just, you know, keep the kids with me. That's okay. And that was great. But then I went and spoke with my chief and sat down in his office, and he advised me that he was going to release my police department photograph to the news and let them know who I was and stuff. And I was thinking of a million different things, but at the time, what I was worried about was my police department picture was what I considered my fat police officer picture, because I had the chicken neck and everything. And I was worried about that. And I even remember asking the chief, can you give me an hour so I could try to thin up this photograph before you release it? And he's like, we're not going to do that. You know, I was worried that, hey, it's going to be on the internet forever. And it is. But that's what I was worried about at the time. But yeah, it's, and I still don't remember much about that weekend. It was all kind of a blur up until Monday when I went to the sheriff's office and met with investigators.
Since you've been undergoing therapy for all of this with your counselor and all, what has been his or her lessons about how people normally, if that's the right word, respond or react following an incident like yours? Did you follow the textbook? Did she or he, that counselor, say, this is pretty much the way that we would have expected you to? Or help me with that, if that question makes sense.
Oh, yeah, it absolutely does. And like you said, you know, I do see a therapist. This is a tactical police vest, and you see police officers wearing this. And, you know, I have another patch here, and it says, I see a therapist. And I do. I see one every Monday at 5 p.m. I'm sitting on the couch talking to my therapist, and I absolutely love her. She's great. And a lot of the ways that I coped over the years was, you know, very, very poorly. I have another patch here, and it explains some of my coping strategies, and they were alcohol, casual sex, and drugs. And, you know, when I shared this with my therapist, and when I share this with other people, they tell me, Adam, the way you're coping is more common than you realize. You're not the only one. And it didn't make me feel better about my behavior and about, you know, how I coped, but it made me realize that there's so many people out there that do cope this way. And, you know, just to touch on alcohol, I did. I abused alcohol. And when I say abused alcohol, I have a 750 milliliter bottle of vodka here. And I would drink that in 30 minutes or less and then just sleep the day away. I would also stop by gas stations before I would go somewhere, and I would buy two or three of these small little Fireball whiskey bottles, and I would drink them right in my car before I drove out of the parking lot, and then throw them in the back seat, or I would throw them out the window now, when I'm driving to my destination.
Let me back up here.
Sure.
Are you still on the department at this time?
I am. I always did that off duty. I never drank on the job. I always did this on my days off, but I am. I was cleared from the shooting, and I went back to work, and I continued to do my job. And even a year after my shooting, I was promoted to the police department's first detective. So not only was I dealing with my shooting, but then I would go to homicides, suicides, fatal crashes. So all the cumulative stress from that, and trying to, while I was poorly coping with my shooting, all this other stuff just kept piling on and piling on.
I'm thinking of something that was said earlier as a part of that coping strategy, and you're being calloused, different officers being calloused in situations. Had the shooting incident that you were involved with, do you believe that calloused you? Did it make you more sensitive, or can you even identify where you were at that time?
I can. It didn't make me calloused. It made me more, I have another patch, and this patch says hypervigilant. I was hypervigilant. I was tuned in, more tuned in than I had ever been. What if, what if, what if, what if this happens? When I knocked on the door, what if somebody barges out with a gun or a knife? Or so I wasn't calloused. It did make me a lot more sensitive. It made me more tuned in and aware of my environment than I had ever been before.
So with these label strips that you keep showing us, do you wear those publicly today? How do those work for you?
I don't. I just wear them during public speaking, or I do them like I'm speaking with you, Randy. And I do that because kind of a visual aid, a lot of people, when they see police officers, they can see the patch. They can usually, they can see the police, but they don't see hypervigilance. They don't see alcohol, casual sex, and drugs. They don't see, I see a therapist. But that is the reality of being a first responder, not for everybody, but for some of us. And that's okay. It's okay to be that way.
We've had several first responder type individuals here on our program. We hear about how they're called out to an accident. They're taking care of a three-year-old who dies in their arms. They take care of the situation as far as they can. They go back to their facility, their post, whatever it may be called, and they pour a drink, and before they can get it down, they're called to another incident. In no possible way could they have even begun to process what they'd just been through, and they're asked to do it again for the next 8 hours of their shift after serving 4 hours. So it's just an unbelievably complicated thing. But I like your labels there, okay, that you've given yourself.
Thank you.
Pictures worth a thousand words. Well, those words you have on paint the picture that we don't often consider, or we don't often get to identify.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What kept you moving forward? You mentioned the alcohol, the casual sex was on the one, the drugs. We're going to talk more about those in a moment. But Adam, what kept you moving forward? How did you not just break down into a pile of broken person?
I think a lot of it has to do with early in my life, my parents instilled good work ethics and good morals in me. And, even in the military, I learned a lot of stuff, even though I didn't go to war or any conflicts, but I just felt I got to keep going. I got a job to do. I got to help people. I'm not going to give up. I love being a cop. I love it. And people say, oh, don't love your job. It's not going to love you back. I do. I love being a cop. So I just kept going, you know, and getting promoted to detective. I had never thought ever that I was going to be a detective. And now, hey, I'm a detective. So now I got to do a good job. And I wanted to do a good job. I love being a cop. So I just kept going. And I think my poor coping strategies, I just would do those on my days off. Or on my Friday when I would go home, knowing I had 3 days off, you know, then I'd hit the bottle that night and do it for 2 days and then have 1 day to recover and then go back to work. But I love that community. I love working at that police department, the people I worked with, the people I worked for. And I had a job to do. I was back at work and let's just keep going.
I'm going to guess you're the kind of person who has higher expectations of himself than anybody could possibly have for you, and that you're going to continue to battle to meet that personal expectation. Is that pretty close?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. And I'm very self-critical of myself too. I mean, I notice things that other people don't. And I speak with my mom about certain things and she's like, Adam, you did a great job. Nobody sees what you're talking about. You know, you did fine. And even when people thank me for doing certain things, I might make kind of a excuse or, you know, my mom's like, sometimes you just need to shut up and say thank you and you're welcome. And that's it, because people aren't going to say thank you if they don't really mean it. And yeah, I mean, you're right, Randy.
I had somebody do that to me the other day. They just told me face to face, I have something to say and you're not to say a word. And it was very flattering and a little uncomfortable in that respect, but it was their heart and their feelings. I accepted it. Yeah. Go ahead. We've got about another 10 minutes here with this episode, 8 or 9, and we're just going to jump right into episode 2 here in a little while, folks. So stay with us. There's a lot more story. We're hearing the background. We want to hear what Adam's about today. He's got a not-for-profit going on. I also want to go back, and I saw the tag you had on there a little bit ago that talked about the addiction. Share with us the addiction. I know that there was a lot of self-harm involved in your recovery process, as well as the suicidal ideations.
Sure. I mean, I have that patch again, and it does. It says alcohol, casual sex, and drugs. And, you know, we touched on alcohol, but with the casual sex, I would meet women online mutually to have sex. And there were times that we'd meet, and within 30 minutes, we're having sex. There were even times I would meet somebody, let's say, at 10 a.m., and we'd have sex, and then I'd meet somebody else at 3 and have sex. And, you know, sex to me is fun, exciting, playful. It's something you share with somebody that you care about. But this was strictly just to feel good and kind of it was to numb the pain, to help me escape. And I remember laying in bed with a woman one time after we had sex, and I'm thinking, this ain't working for you anymore, Adam. You need to knock this off. I started not liking who I was. And, I was always worried, too, that what if I get her pregnant? What if I catch an STD? But even with that worry, it wasn't enough for me to stop. But, then we talk about drugs. I tried marijuana for the first time in my life. And a lot of people think, pot's no big deal. So what? But so what? It was a big deal to me, because all my life I prided myself in not doing any kind of drugs and staying away from that. Randy, I remember when I went to the MEP station before going into the Army, and some of the officers were asking me, have you ever done marijuana? And I said, no. And their response was, mm-hmm. I mean, you could tell they didn't believe me, but I'm thinking, I didn't. And they said, well, you know, you can still be military police if you did. You just have to be honest. And I was like, I've never done that. But after my shooting, my behavior and my poor coping, I didn't care. I didn't care about anything. I wanted to feel good instantly, numb the pain. You know, there was no one limit. Time that, yeah, I mean, there was one time that it was during the 4th of July weekend. It was the week before the 4th of July weekend, and I didn't want to work. And I felt like I had already, I was out of excuses. I could have went into my chief, because my chief supported me. I could have said, Chief, I don't know why, but I just can't work this weekend. It's just too much for me. But what did I do? I have a 12-inch wrench right here. And what I did was I struck my knee several times to the point where it caused redness, abrasions, bruising. And then I went into the urgent care at the hospital, and I lied. And I said I fell down my back steps and hit my knee on a manhole cover that covered the septic tank. So it's a hospital. So what did they do? They checked x-rays. They gave me a prescription for pain meds. They gave me a doctor's excuse. They gave me crutches. And then I hobbled into the police chief's office saying, here's my doctor's excuse. I can't work. And I still feel guilty about that because I lied. I lied to my chief, the one man that I absolutely know supported me 100%. But I felt like I had to lie to get out of work. What you mentioned about self-harm, another thing about self-harm is suicide. I mean, this patch right here is suicide. That's the real deal. You can't come back from that. And I guess there was a part of me that wanted to die by suicide. I can't explain what I'm about to share with you because it still doesn't make much sense to me. But I mean, this is a complete plastic replica of my duty weapon. There's no working parts. It's all plastic. But what I would do is when I was intoxicated, I would remove the magazine, clear the chamber to take the bullet out, the round out. And then I would put it to my temple and pull the trigger so I could hear that metallic click. There's a metallic click when you pull the trigger of a gun. And I don't know why I did that. I easily did that a dozen times, but I never thought about killing myself. But then how do you explain that? And then I'm thinking, how many times did I do that when I was so blackout drunk that I don't remember? I could have killed myself. And my family or friends would have found me, and they probably would have been like, we get it. Adam was depressed. He's sad. But I never really wanted to kill myself. But I don't have any other explanation to that. I mean, that's so self-destructive. I mean, that could have ended my life.
Adam, let's finish up this segment over the next 2 or 3 minutes here. Is there okay. Anything you want to back up on or add to what you've said, or a warning you want to give or a caution to folks?
I want to talk about mental health. And I know we're talking about that now, but I just want people to know that it's okay to talk about your mental health. You're not alone. Please don't suffer in silence. If you're struggling with addiction, alcohol, drugs, sex, anything, there's so many people out there that are willing to help you. And not just because they're getting paid for it, not just because it's their job. One thing that helps me, I mean, we talk about a therapist. And one thing I'll talk about also, I have another patch. And I take medication. And here it is right here, 20 milligrams of Lexapro. I wake up every morning, I go to the bathroom, I pop a pill, and I continue on my day. This helps me. Therapy helps me. Speaking with you, Randy, this is therapeutic. So please, there's so many resources out there if you're struggling. It's not easy to get help. It's not easy to take that first step, but it's so important and it can be helpful.
Awesome. You know what? As we go into this next episode here in just a moment, which we're going to do almost immediately, let's begin once again with the mental health. Through some personal losses and all, I've watched what mental health can do. And we want to give right. the folks some encouragement. And I like what you had to say. The key and the biggest thing we can ask for in our lives sometimes is help me. There's right. no shame in that game. We all have our shortcomings chemically and everything else. So let's just go ahead here. We'll go into this next episode and discuss that. Folks, hang on. We're ready to hit you again here. God bless, and thanks for listening to this one. Go back and hear it all.